Hello, my little nightmares. Welcome back to Mrs. Nightmare Storytime. I have a collection of terrifying Halloween tales for you tonight. I hope you enjoy. My neighbor's pumpkins never rot. The butcher boys, Chet, Eli, and Rex, the bane of my existence. They picked me as a target when we were still finger painting and learning our ABCs. Maybe it was because Rex, the youngest brother and my classmate, didn't like the way I wrinkled my nose at his stench. Maybe it was just because I sat next to him and I was smaller than he was. Who knows? I'll never understand what motivates people to hurt others for fun. But whatever it is, the butcher boys had it in abundance. As soon as Rex told his older brothers Eli and Chet that I was an easy target, my life became a nightmare. Every day after school, the hunt was on. The moment that the yellow school bus turned the corner or the adults disappeared, the butcher boys materialized, like demons out of the shadows. They appeared in the gloom of the pine forest shortcut, behind tall wooden fences, or pressed up against the siding of empty suburban houses. I never knew which route home would be safe, because I never knew where they'd be. It was fun for them. Like lions, they lay in wait. And also like big cats, they like to play with their food before eating it. In the woods or along the sidewalk, I'd run until my pumping legs burned or my asthmatic lungs ran out of oxygen. The butcher boys were faster than me, and they knew it. So they'd let me get away. Almost. At the last minute, my legs would be yanked out from under me, or I'd be yanked helpless from the top of a fence. If I was lucky, I'd just get a snake bite, or have my face rubbed in something nasty until I choked and cried. I wasn't always lucky. Adults didn't understand that if I followed their advice and just told someone or fought back, it would only make things worse. Things got worse by themselves as the butcher boys got older. Their taste for cruelty became more refined as a connoisseur develops a nose for fine wines. When neighborhood cats and dogs began to disappear, I didn't have to wonder where they went. When my English teacher was in tears over damage to her car that she couldn't afford to fix, I didn't have to ask myself who did it. I wasn't the butcher boy's only victim by a long shot, but I was the only one who lived in their neighborhood. The only one whose parents weren't rich enough to just move away or change schools. I was the only target who was always available, the one they could count on when they ran out of windows to break or small creatures to torment. It goes without saying, of course, that I hated Halloween. No matter the mask or costume that I hid myself behind, Rex, Eli, and Chet found me and did whatever they wanted after taking my candy. Year after year, however, my parents forced me to dress up and go outside, thinking it would help me make friends. Yet, since everyone knew that the butcher boys were after me, they avoided me like the plague. Later, when I'd come home with my costume in tatters and my plastic pumpkin empty of sweets, I'd be grounded for not trying hard enough. Of course, I was mostly alone in my dislike for Halloween. The whole town seemed to love the holiday, and people really got into their costumes and decorations. No one more than Mrs. Throgmorton, an older woman who lived alone in the house at the end of a cul-de-sac for as long as anyone could remember. The homemade caramel apples she gave out were delicious, although some people claimed that they caused unusual dreams. Trayvon Banks, for example, said after he ate one, he dreamed he turned into a toad, and Miss Throgmorton used him as bait to catch other toads in the swamp out by the highway. Melissa Elder, too, claimed that after eating the apple, she went straight to her parents' diaries, read all their passwords and juicy secrets, then went to Miss Throgmorton's house in her pajamas to repeat everything, verbatim. Everyone thought Melissa was lying, naturally, but we couldn't explain the ink on her fingertips or the cuts on her bare feet. Rumors or not, Miss Throgmorton's apples were a Halloween staple, and her decorations couldn't be bought in any store. animatronic, talking scarecrows that always had an ironic comment or bad pun to make about your costume. Fake cobwebs that seemed to skitter with real spiders and centipedes. Ghostly figures that popped out from rose bushes or dropped from doorways, cackling madly. Miss Throgmorton made them all by hand, with loving care. You could see how important Halloween was to her in the way her eyes glittered as she watched us, cat-like, from her front porch rocking chair. Nothing, however, compared to Miss Throgmorton's pumpkins. The year the high school football team made it to state, her carving showed critical game moments in shades of orange and fire. Other years, they would poke fun at local leaders or current events. Sometimes they would be your classic monsters and ghouls. What stood out, however, was the lifelike skill with which they were carved. That was probably what attracted the Butcher Boys, the chance to destroy something so beautiful. As usual, I'd been forced out of my house in costume against my will that night. My classmates still crossed the street when they saw me. I was sulking beneath an oak tree opposite Miss Throgmorton's and daydreaming about life far away from this miserable town when the Butcher Boys caught up to me. For some reason, my costume that year was an adult-sized cat-in-the-hat outfit. I guess my parents had gotten it on sale, and it wasn't like I even tried anymore anyway. But the Butcher Boys put the costume size and goofy accessories to use, stuffing the hat in my mouth, straight jacketing my arms inside the oversized sleeves, and hanging me from a tree limb by the costume's cat tail. My mouth tasted like dusty felt, and I could barely breathe through the sobs and snot in my nose. Blood rushed to my head as I swung helplessly from the creaking branch. I was too busy fighting to stay conscious to pay much attention to the brothers' insults and laughter. Finished with me, they crossed the deserted street to Miss Throgmorton's. I saw what happened next while swinging upside down on the point of losing consciousness. So I suppose it must be taken with a grain of salt. The consequences, however, are undeniable. Miss Throgmorton seemed to have gone in for the night, now that most trick-or-treaters had gone home. There was no one to stop Chet from using the hockey stick from his Jason costume to smash a carefully carved cat pumpkin to smithereens, or to prevent Eli from stomping on sculpture Wolfman. Nor could Rex be prevented from hurling the cutout of a broom-riding witch into the street, where it shattered into waxy yellow chunks. It was around then that a dark shape appeared on the porch. From where I hung, I couldn't hear what the Butcher Boys said to Miss Throgmorton. Probably their usual blend of threats and insults. But when she spoke to them, the results were obvious and instantaneous. Like toy soldiers, the Butcher Boys' hands snapped to their sides. They stood up straight before wobbling to the edge of the rose bushes where Miss Throgmorton's pumpkins used to be. Once in place, they started to dig with the frenzy of starving dogs unearthing a bone. A person shouldn't be able to dig a hole as deep as they are tall with their bare hands, at least not in such a short time. But the Butcher Boys did. Careless of the pain and damage to their bodies, they kept digging, even when their bleeding fingernails peeled away and their joints snapped sickeningly with each movement. When the holes were shoulder deep, they wormed their way inside. Only their faces were visible now. But Chet, Eli, and Rex were no longer sneering. Each face was as blank as a puppet waiting for its strings to be moved. They didn't have to wait for long. Miss Throgmorton wobbled down from her porch and covered each head with a brown potato sack, the kind that she often used around the garden. Then, cackling to herself, she went back inside. I passed out. At some point, the tree branch holding me snapped. Otherwise, the Butcher Boy's little prank would have probably killed me. When I woke up, face down in the pre-dawn dew, I wasn't thinking about the three brown sacks across the street or the impossible things I'd seen. All I cared about was getting home. My parents had left every light on and called the police. They were much too worried to be angry. I could see the love and regret in their eyes as they held me close and promised that they'd never force me to go out on my own again. Their feelings were only intensified the next day, when Arnold Butcher reported his three sons missing. Manhunts, posters, and police dogs came and went, but the three sacks in Miss Throgmorton's yard remained. More out of curiosity than compassion, I tried to get a closer look a few nights after Halloween. Just as I was reaching out for one of the bags, however, I felt a presence behind me. Miss Throgmorton leaned on her railing, grinning at me from ear to ear. I gulped, waved, backed away, and as soon as I could, I ran. That was 5 years ago. Every year since, Miss Throgmorton has continued to outdo herself with the amazing quality of her decorations, and above all, the three pumpkins in her front yard. Nothing can match their lifelike expressions, or how they seem to be in real agony from the candles burning on their tongues. And if anyone in town made the connection between the three perennial pumpkins and the three missing boys, they've kept it to themselves, just as I have. Like me, they've probably noticed that Miss Throgmorton always has room for new decorations. What I got for Halloween. When I was 10, my mother searched through my Halloween candy for the first time. Although she didn't say why, I'd snuck downstairs to hear the late night news. I knew she was looking for needles, razor blades, and poisons. Like Ouija boards, haunted houses, crocodiles in the sewer, and the satanic messages in rock records, I thought the dangers of Halloween were probably just urban legends. But I couldn't be sure. I was having a sleepover with my best friends, Chris, Sammy, and David, that year. The late October sun was as fat and orange as a pumpkin when it disappeared beneath the smoky horizon, and we headed out to trick-or-treat. Chris was a vampire, Sammy was a werewolf, David was a zombie, and I was the clown from It. At the end of the night, some older kids in masks tried to steal our pillowcases full of candy. One of them had a hatchet, and its edge glittered in the suburban streetlight. We made eye contact with each other and silently nodded. When Chris gave the signal, we each took off running in a different direction. We met up on my porch, panting, exhausted, and more than a little spooked. We just wanted to get inside, lock the door, and scare ourselves silly with movies that didn't feel quite as frightening as a real teenager with a real axe. I almost didn't notice the little gift bag tied with orange and black ribbon that sat on our doorstep. I picked it up, curious, and was still holding it when we stepped inside and were confronted by my angry mother. "Do you four have any idea what time it is?" she huffed. "Candy on the counter, now." We all made a big show of moaning, but the truth was we were all happy to be in a bright, warm house with adults around. "That little one, too." I'd almost forgotten about what I was holding. I dumped the contents onto the table. 5 pieces of candy in plain black wrappers. A toy of a hooded figure holding a bloody butcher knife. An antique watch stopped at 1:13 a.m. And a Viewmaster. Plastic binoculars with click-to-view slides within. My mother carefully examined each piece of candy to ensure it was factory-wrapped and free of needle jabs. "Can we have our candy back, please?" I groaned. "Nope," my father winked as he passed by on his well-traveled route from his office to his armchair. "'Cause I'm gonna eat it all." He snagged one of the strange black candies, unwrapped it, and popped it into his mouth. He didn't make it 5 steps before the wrapper fell from his hands. My father grasped his throat and his face turned purple. "Honey, honey, are you all right?" My mother sprung to her feet as horrific choking sounds gurgled up from my father's throat. As my mother reached him, the noises stopped. "Yep, it's definitely poisoned," my father laughed. My mother punched him in the arm. He was still snickering when he walked upstairs. Before long, my parents were completing their nighttime rituals, while Chris, Sammy, David, and I rode a sugar high. My friends never got tired of bad movies and cheesy special effects. But I soon left the blue glow of the screen behind to wander through the dark and silent house. Not exactly sure what I was looking for. I stepped on the wrapper my father had dropped earlier. The outside was completely black, but the foil inside featured a single word. Am. I shrugged and opened another piece of candy as I fiddled with the knife-wielding toy figure. This wrapper said, get. Were they supposed to make some sort of word if we put them together? Get am or am get? It didn't make any sense. I went back to the basement where my friends laughed in beanbag chairs and tossed popcorn at each other. They yelled at me when I turned on a table lamp, but I was focused. I put my eyes up to the Viewmaster's lens. Spookomatic, read the first slide. A cute white ghost cartoon floated beside the words. Click. A cornfield surrounded by forest. Blackbirds pecking at a scarecrow hanging from a lonely post. The scarecrow is backlit by the cloudy sky, but its stitched-together gray skin looks incredibly lifelike. Click. An abandoned farmhouse in a rain-soaked field. The broken doorway is like an empty mouth, and the smears of mud on the porch suggest that several heavy things have recently been dragged inside. Click. Some candlelit pumpkins on a porch. I get a strange feeling that I've seen those carven faces before. The street in the background seems familiar as well. Click. A loud crash interrupted my viewing. Sammy was wrestling with Chris, who was bragging that he knew an inescapable wrestling hold. David booed and threw popcorn while I warned them to keep the noise down. Giggling at our own pathetic efforts to be quiet, we pushed the furniture up against the walls and tried to pin each other with moves we'd seen on TV, until we were sweaty, exhausted, and mad at each other. Still not ready for sleep, we put A Nightmare on Elm Street on in the background and prepared for a serious game of truth or dare. The gallons of Mountain Dew we'd been drinking had their predictable effect, and soon enough Chris was scrambling upstairs to use the bathroom. On his way back down, he grabbed us each a few handfuls of candy. I noticed he was chomping on one of the strange black toffees. "What's this line inside the wrapper?" he frowned. "Huh." Chris picked up the Spookomatic and gasped. "Dude, it's your house!" I grappled the device away from Chris. He wasn't kidding. The most recent slide looked like a blurry photo of my family home, maybe taken from the woods in the backyard. The tiny black figures inside the twilight windows could easily have been my parents and I just a few days earlier. The others pushed and shoved to get a look as well, and accidentally clicked forward. A boy sleeps in a dimly lit second-story bedroom. I recognized the Terminator poster on the wall, the model planes hanging from the ceiling, and the books scattered on the old school desk, because the room is mine, and the boy is me. I hurled the Spookomatic at the wall as though it might bite me. David, who hadn't been paying much attention to the commotion we were making, cleared his throat. Guys, he held up one of the black toffee wrappers. Ready was written on the silver foil. I rifled through the pile of candy until I found the final black toffee and tore it open. Coming, it read. Heart pounding, I put the wrappers in order, and I discovered that Chris's line was really an I. Get ready, I whispered aloud. I am coming. Oh, spooky, David rolled his eyes. I mean, I guess it's a good prank, though. The watch. I shook Sammy. What time did it say on the watch? Sammy couldn't remember. The clock read 1:11 a.m. I was hurrying to the kitchen to find the last piece of the puzzle when I heard movement on the back porch. I pressed my back against the couch and tried to stop my heaving breaths. Something scraped against the glass door. I kicked on the patio light, bathing the porch in white radiance. The hooded figure in the pale mannequin mask was identical to the tiny toy sitting on the counter. 1:13 read the watch and the digital clock on the microwave. The figure outside cocked its head at me, then grabbed a brick and smashed through the glass door. I ran downstairs screaming. I heard commotion in my parents' bedroom, but I wasn't even thinking about them. My animal brain screamed only two messages, run, and hide. Upstairs, I heard the sound of our family's treasured possessions being thrown, hacked apart, and shattered. Adult footsteps charged down the stairs as my friends scrambled to disappear behind doors or under furniture. It was pathetic. In the cramped basement, there was nowhere to hide. The hooded, masked figure kicked the TV screen, plunging the room into darkness. As we choked back tears and held our breath, we could feel the figure stalking around the room, throwing furniture and laughing, laughing, laughing. That laughter in the dark continued until police sirens sounded in the distance, and my father finally kicked down the door to the basement, which the intruder had propped shut using a chair. Slash marks covered the walls and furniture. Shattered dishware and picture frames covered the floor. The intruder escaped through an unused air vent at the back of our basement crawlspace. The police later said that our attacker might have come and gone from the house any number of times before, via the same route. Somehow, however, my family and friends were alive and unharmed. Physically, anyway. Psychologically, some of us for life. I normally don't like to dredge up these memories from the past, but it's hard not to fear for my own children around Halloween. This year, they've finally twisted my arm. I let them go trick-or-treating. I insisted that their mother go with them, armed, so I'm not too concerned about that part of the evening. What bothers me is the little bag I found on my porch, tied with black and orange ribbon. I've just finished opening it, unwrapping the black toffees inside, and laying out their message. Ready for round two? There's a Halloween song we're forbidden from singing. I found out why. When I signed up for a national teaching program, I imagined I'd be sent to the Chicago inner city or the deep south, not this quaint, quiet town. I just couldn't understand why the place struggled to keep teachers, or any other out-of-town professional for that matter. There were always vacancies, even though there's virtually no crime. Friendly people and, most of all, beautiful countryside. When the colors change in fall, the town looks like a postcard. Better than a postcard, in fact, because no flat image could capture the vibrant yellows, flaming oranges, and rich ruby reds that cover every hillside. Tourists drive for miles just to stroll through the colorful rain of falling leaves, or snap pictures of the morning mist rolling through apple orchards and barnyards. As a lover of pumpkin spice, Halloween, and all things fall, I was in heaven. Starting at the beginning of October, elementary-age students decorated the classroom with paper cutouts of ghosts and cobwebs. We carved pumpkins, bobbed for apples, and read the legend of Sleepy Hollow. To my surprise, I got a lot of positive phone calls from parents, praising the work I'd put into my classes and telling me how much their children had enjoyed them. Principal Harris even pulled me aside to tell me how impressed he was and mentioned that if I kept it up, he'd pull all the strings he could to get me a permanent position. Everything was going great until the day of the Halloween sing-along. I'd ordered a CD of spooky but kid-friendly songs, and on the chosen day, we turned out the lights, put lit candles inside the pumpkins we'd carved, and sat in a circle to sing. I could feel the children's anticipation build as I turned on the CD player and hit play. After a few creepy sound effects of fluttering bats, screams, and witch cackles, the first track began. Have you seen the ghost of John? Long white bones with the skin all gone. Ooh, 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 ooh. Wouldn't it be chilly with no skin on? As the second verse began, I looked around the classroom. Something was very wrong. The children, who usually loved to sing, were silent, except a few who were crying. Most of them had plugged their ears with their hands. I'd expected the songs to be spooky, but this? Running footsteps announced the arrival of Principal Harris. He sprinted across the classroom and turned off the CD player, like someone disabling a bomb at the final second. Are you nuts? He panted. We're going to have a talk about this after your class. Don't ever play that song in this town again. Understand? Give them, I don't know, some notes to study or something. The after-class meeting with Principal Harris was awkward, but I wasn't sure if it was worse for him or for me. He kept picking things up from his desk and setting them down again, looking out the window and sighing. Finally, he cleared his throat and got to the point. "As you know," Harris began cautiously, "this is a very old town. We even have one of those George Washington slept here, B&Bs. Can you believe that?" He tried to force a laugh. It died in his throat. "Anyway, old small towns like ours tend to have a lot of superstitions. They might seem silly to outsiders, but they're very important to us." It was clear who the outsider was in this situation. Seeing my daydreams of a bright future in this town disappearing fast, I cleared my throat and replied, "If I've done something offensive, I'm sorry. It wasn't my intention, and I appreciate you letting me know so that it won't happen again. Do a lot of people in town have a religious objection to Halloween, or is it more like..."
"No, no, nothing like that," Harris scoffed. "We're not a bunch of Bible-thumping hillbillies up here. It's that specific song and that specific story, in fact, that I need to ask you to avoid."
"What? You mean that old folk song? The ghost of..."
"Yes, that one. No need to say more. Let's just not mention it again, all right? You're doing great work here, miss. I'd hate to see it cut short because of a silly misunderstanding."
"But why?"
"Let's just drop it, okay?"
Harris was almost pleading. It was like even discussing the song was too much for him.
"I think I've said all I need to, and you need to get back to class."
Another fake laugh.
"Look, just one other thing. You can expect some, negative reactions around town when the children tell their parents about class today. Try to take it in stride. Remember, this is a very, very sensitive topic for us, miss."
I left the ugly fluorescent glow of Principal Harris's office with a bad taste in my mouth and a burning curiosity. What could be so bad about a song, especially one that was hundreds of years old? I went through the rest of the day on autopilot and bolted for the library as soon as I could. The storied old building with its red brick and shadowy white columns was one of my favorite places in town. I'd spent hours there reading, preparing materials, or just chatting with the librarian, Sarah Newman.
"Hey, Sarah," I waved to the frizzy mass of hair at the reception desk. "How's it going?"
"Hello,"
Mrs. Newman replied curtly. "Can I help you?"
I was put off by my friend's reaction, but I wasn't about to stop now.
"I wanted to ask you..."
"I'm afraid I'm very busy."
Sarah Newman cut me off, adjusted her glasses, and went back to furiously stamping library books. But I noticed that she glanced up at me again, with a twinge of sympathy in her eye.
"If you want to learn about town history, I suggest you check the newspaper archives, specifically the October issues from 1989, 1972, and 1958. Should do nicely."
The rubber stamp resumed its pounding. Our conversation was over. Soon, I was reading the headlines from October 1989. October 1st. Students to sing about local legend in Halloween chorus. October 8th. Protest against cursed sing-along. Are our children in danger? October 15th. A spooky success. Halloween chorus plays to a full house. October 22nd. Local children abducted. Police suspect the worst. October 29th. 5 students found dead. Details inside. October 1972. October 1st. New York folklorist to study local legend. October 8th. A stranger in town. An interview with folklorist James Hatterwood. October 15th. Stay out of our graves. Hatterwood's investigation sparks controversy. October 22nd. New York folklorist James Hatterwood missing. Volunteers needed. October 29th. An unfinished tale? Hatterwood disappearance remains unsolved. And 1958. October 5th. Good Time Girls and Hooligans. A look inside the teen motorcycle craze.
October 12th. Miscreants are misunderstood. City Council to ban teenage bikers. October 19th. Angry greasers adopt local legend as their mascot. Council concerned. October 26th. Accident or foul play. Parents weep at tragic biker club pileup. The newspaper room was in the basement, and a chill ran over me as I read the articles. It wasn't hard to imagine what the local legend must be. The ghost of John. I didn't believe in ghouls or curses, but it was easy to see why the legend was a sore spot for the locals. I resolved to never mention it again. As I climbed up the dim, creaky stairs, a loud buzzing nearly made me jump out of my skin. I had dozens of missed calls. I listened to the voicemails as I drove home. Each one was worse than the last. Parents who only days before had been calling me a blessing, or my child's favorite, were now screaming at me, threatening my life, ordering me out of town, and in a few cases, all three. It brought me to tears. These were the people who baked me cookies and showed me around town. How could a simple song have made them so thoughtlessly cruel? By the time I got home, my sadness had turned to tight-fisted anger. Or at least that's what I tell myself to justify what I did next. None of this was fair. How was I supposed to know about some dumb superstition? I was still sniffling and wiping my red, puffy eyes when I got out of the car and waved to the Volkers, my neighbors across the street. The two Volker children left their toys on the lawn and went inside without saying a word. Their parents followed them, turning out the porch light as they went. More hot tears streamed down my cheeks. Without thinking twice, I pulled out the CD of Halloween songs and jammed it into my car CD player. With doors and windows open, I skipped through the tracks in search of one song in particular. When I found it, I played it at full volume. Have you seen the ghost of John? Long white bones with the skin all gone. Ooh, 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 ooh. Wouldn't it be chilly with no skin on? I watched as one by one porch lights went out and people enjoying the autumn evening scurried back into their houses. I was left alone in the driveway of my rented house, sobbing pitifully into the smoky October twilight. When I awoke the next morning, I had a few happy, quiet moments in my warm bedsheets before I remembered what I'd done. When I did, however, the anger and shame hit me like a punch to the gut. My morning coffee did hula hoops around my stomach. I dreaded what was coming when I got to school. To my surprise, no one mentioned anything. It was like the day before had never happened. Sure, my coworkers suddenly seemed more guarded around me, but there were no red-faced parents looking for a fight, dismissal letters, or hordes of sobbing children. The closest anyone came to mentioning the song was a boy in my second period class.
"Hey, miss, aren't we gonna finish the song?" he asked.
"Shut up, Clayton," the girl next to him jabbed an elbow into his rib.
"What?" Clayton shrugged. "I like it, just because our parents are all freaked out."
"Clayton, we can't," another girl hissed. The class began to murmur. I had a teachable moment here. It was time to decide whether I was going to support the local superstition or encourage the kids to think for themselves. "I made a mistake playing that song yesterday, Clayton," I replied sweetly. "It bothers a lot of people, and we need to respect their feelings." I felt like a coward, but I didn't care. All I wanted was to put this whole thing behind me. I wanted to go back to how things were when I was first walking around town, coffee in hand, watching the leaves fall. A few quiet days passed. I was beginning to think that I'd survived the first major classroom scandal of my teaching career. A little wiser, a little sadder maybe, but mostly unscathed. I decided to celebrate. I'd clear my head by visiting some of the kitschy tourist attractions in the small towns nearby. As I drove, however, the weather took a turn for the worse. The misty morning clouds became a weird yellowish gray, and fat raindrops began to fall. Even with my wipers going full blast, it was hard to see. There was something wrong about this weather, something unnatural that put me on edge. That's why I nearly jumped out of my skin when I heard a loud revving behind me. Who would be riding a motorcycle in this weather? The way the black riders appeared out of the rain made me think of the Headless Horsemen. But the logo on their leather jackets referenced a different legend. Even in the pouring rain, I could read the bone-white letters around their skeletal mascot, the Ghosts of John. There was music playing above the sound of the rain. Was that Elvis? Shake, rattle, and roll? 6 motorcycles had closed in around me, 3 on either side, and soon I couldn't even hear the rain over the rumble of their engines. What did they want? If this was a joke, it was in very bad taste. If this was meant to scare me, it was working. I gripped the steering wheel tightly, but it felt like my wheels were already hydroplaning on the wet pavement. The mysterious bikers surrounded my car, their rain-ragged shadows drawing closer and closer on each side. Their bodies, or long white bones, were hidden by black leather, and behind their scarred helmets, their faces. With the skin all gone, were completely anonymous. I couldn't maneuver past without their permission, and they knew it. It was getting harder and harder to see. The rain was a gray sheet that covered even the dead branches of the roadside trees. As the road curved, I noticed the cyclists around me were pushing me, forcing me to make sharper and sharper turns to avoid hitting them. I would even have risked it if I wasn't sure that hitting one of them would make me have an accident myself. I don't know how long they kept it up, the cheesy 50s music, the deafening engines, the knuckle-whiting head games. It was meant to break me for what came next. The Ghosts of John began to slow down. They wanted to force me to stop, to make me face the 6 of them alone on a storm-washed country road. My heart pounding, I skidded to a stop with them in a gravel pull-off. They shut off their engines. Without that roaring, the only sound was the wind-lashed rain. In unison, the dark figures dismounted. Slowly, one turned toward me, reaching for his helmet, about to reveal what lay beneath. I stomped on the accelerator. The riders had left a gap in their wall when they dismounted their antique cycles, and I took it. Although whether I passed through their line because I got lucky or because the bikers were something otherworldly, I couldn't say. I swerved madly on the slick, windy roads, nearly crashed through the guardrail of a bridge and into the roaring waters below. Maybe that, I realized, was the point. I drove home as fast as the wretched weather would allow. I'm not sure if it was the damp, the stress, or something else, but my experience with the Dark Riders put me into bed with chills and a fever. Sleeping and waking, dreams and hallucinations blended so easily that I was unable to tell the difference. Like the man who I saw and heard pacing through the house, lost in thought. He had the long bowl cut and beard of the 70s style, and the suit jacket elbow patches of a college professor. When my eyes would flicker open, I'd sometimes spot him at my desk, scrutinizing yellowed manuscripts. The phantasmal professor's presence was almost comforting, at first. As time passed, his behavior became more and more erratic, swinging from ecstasy to plate-smashing rage. I'm sure I imagined the next part, because no human could have survived it. I woke in the depths of fever, sometime in the lost hours of the night, and dragged myself to the kitchen to make a cup of tea. When I returned, I saw the professor, plain as day, backlit by the lamplight. He was surrounded by dangling skeletal figures, like puppets. They hung from every available surface. In front of him was an antique wooden trunk. He held a Bowie knife in his hand, and he was laughing. "Of course, of course," I thought I heard him giggle. "So simple, why didn't I see it before?" Cheerfully humming the song, the professor peeled away thick, juicy cuts of his own flesh. He kept going, in fact, until there was nothing left. When he'd finished, he put the skin suit in the chest and sealed it, carried it off, still chuckling to himself. I blinked. The hideous vision disappeared. I slipped back beneath the sheets, sipped my tea, wondering what my feverish brain would kick up next. By Monday, I felt better. The hallucinations and bizarre dreams had stopped, but I was still left with more questions than answers. I decided to visit Sarah again at the library. The moment Sarah saw me walk through the door, however, she scurried off. I finally caught up to her in the stacks, trying to look busy.
You're avoiding me, I accused her.
Oh, I have no idea what you're I
did the research you suggested. I even played the song again.
At this, Sarah stopped speaking and went pale. She looked to both ends of the narrow shelves, as though she expected monsters to come and carve us up.
You shouldn't have done that, the librarian muttered to herself.
The more you play it, the more you talk about it, the more you think about it, the worse it gets.
Her eyes darted from side to side again.
It's too dim back here. We're alone. We shouldn't even be discussing this.
But how did it start? I wondered aloud. I mean, if it's even real, then surely there must be a way to stop it.
If it's even real, Sarah hissed, I can see in your face that it has started happening to you too. And you dare doubt it? If you've let the song into your life this far and you're still alive, I don't know what to tell you. Get away from here and forget about it. If it isn't already too late, I am not talking about this.
I told her about the bikers. She looked miserable the whole time, half wanting to cover her ears, half dying to know more.
Leaving town is out then, she murmured to herself. It'll get you on the roads.
I told her about the professor.
It's in your house already then, Sarah frowned. It's too late.
She gave my shoulder a little squeeze.
I'm sorry.
Hurrying off, she turned one last time.
And we did not have this conversation.
I was expected back at school the next day. Back among my piles of sheet music and childish instruments, I barely remembered where I'd left off. But it didn't take me long to find out. It warmed my heart how the students welcomed me back and even helped me find my place in their lessons. To them, of course, I'd only been out sick. They had no idea of the nightmare I'd been living since I'd played the song. The older ones waved to me with toothy grins, and the younger ones gave me those headbutting hugs that small children seem to specialize in. I just needed to distract myself, I thought. So I did something I'd sworn I'd never do. I played Christmas music in October. The kids were a little shocked, but the change of season did me good. In the classroom singing Jingle Bells and learning the history of St. Nick, it was easy to pretend that I'd never heard of ghosts, hauntings, or Halloween. Outside the school building, however, the late autumn air seemed eager to remind me. Instead of crisp white snowdrifts, dead brown leaves swirled beneath the bare skeletons of the trees. Instead of colorful lights and holly, houses were decorated with fake cobwebs, wooden tombstones, and other reminders of the long hand of death. Instead of ice skaters and carolers, the streets abounded with children in costumes that, for the first time, struck me as grotesque, twisted, and wrong. When trick-or-treaters jumped out from behind hay bales or pumpkin piles, their masked faces frightened me far more than their intended targets, who ran away shrieking gleefully. What was fun for them had become, for me, deadly serious. I realized how much I'd been affected when I looked out the kitchen window a few nights before Halloween. I screamed silently when I saw the long white bones of a skeleton beneath the twisted apple tree in front of the house. It was watching me. I don't know how long I stood, staring into the black pits of its eyes, at its hideous bony grin, its dead intensity. But I finally realized that it wasn't moving. With a kitchen knife in my trembling fist, I crept outside to face it. I saw the string. I gave the skeleton a shove. Plastic. I was still laughing at my own pathetic fate when I felt a tug on my elbow that made me turn. A child was there. It was one of my students.
"Excuse me, miss," the child rasped. "Can I have some of your skin?"
"What?" I was sure I'd misunderstood.
"Can I have your skin, miss? It sure is chilly with no skin on."
That was when I realized that the child wasn't wearing a costume. The thing before me was draped in a simple blanket, like a mortuary sheet, that was stained red. It was the kind of stain that might come from a small body with all of its flesh flayed off, I thought.
there were no eye or mouth holes for a child to breathe through the blood-soaked fabric, and it held only a single tallow candle for light. I backed away slowly. I didn't start running until four other identical shapes drifted out of the gloom, candles flickering on their faceless wrappings. Despite their small size and inability to see, they pursued me quickly through the bracken, mud, and heaps of leaves. They'd come between me and my rented house, and like a panicked animal, I bolted dead ahead and straight into the woods behind my house. Soon, the only light came from the candles held by the five child-sized figures that pursued me through the damp and foggy darkness. Tripping and slipping over gnarled roots and rotten logs, I understood with horror that I was being herded. The destination was clear, a silvery clearing dominated by a single dead tree. Now that I've stood in that clearing, I say that I have, indeed, seen the ghost of John. Oh yes, we all have. The five student singers, Professor Hatterwood, the town's first motorcycle gang, other figures too old to name, and still others who walked in those woods before names even existed. We all have seen those long white bones. I don't know why I was allowed to leave the clearing. Perhaps the ghosts wanted its song and story spread. Or perhaps it knows that I'll be back before All Hallows' Eve. You see, where that haunted child touched my elbow, a gray spot began to grow. Little by little, the flesh around it grew pale and crumbled away like dust. Most of my left arm is bone now, and the change seems to be growing faster. It sure is going to be chilly with no skin on. Thank you for listening to Mrs. Nightmare Storytime. I hope you enjoy your spooky season. Good night.